From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Ta-Nehisi Coates grew up in West Baltimore, where he says to be black was to be naked before guns, fists, and knives, and you had to learn to stand up for yourself.
You know, one of the first things I learned in middle school is that any sort of physically, you know, violent threat made to you has to be responded to with force.
Coates' new book is written as a letter to his teenage son at a time when cell phone videos have been documenting police killing and beating young black men. Coates shares his personal experiences and his knowledge of American history to reflect on the fears that lead to the violence so many young African Americans are exposed to on the streets, in their schools, and from police. Coates is a national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews Go Set a Watchman, which features an older, now racist, Atticus Finch.
Hi, podcast listeners. I'm Audrey Bentham, Fresh Air's technical director. I assemble each day's podcast, and I wanted to let you know that at the end of this podcast, we have a podcast extra, a few minutes more of our interview with Ta-Nehisi Coates. He has some really interesting things to say about the Confederate flag and on learning about nonviolence in school, only to face violence on the streets after leaving school. We didn't have time to fit these parts of the conversation into our radio broadcast, so we hope you'll stick around right after the credits to hear those chapters as an extra on this podcast.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In a time when so many African-American parents are worried that their son will become the next Trayvon Martin or Michael Brown, my guest Ta-Nehisi Coates has written a book in the form of a letter to his teenage son. It's titled Between the World and Me, and it draws on history as well as personal experience to discuss the different forms of violence young African-Americans are especially vulnerable to from all directions, on the street, in school, and from the police. Coates was born in 1975 and grew up in West Baltimore, where he says everyone had lost a child somehow to the streets, to jail, to drugs, to guns. Coates is a national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. He won a National Magazine Award and a George Polk Award for his cover story, The Case for Reparations, about the long history of what he calls white-imposed black disadvantage. It focused on how housing discrimination was enforced by private covenants, banks, and government policies and kept black people in ghettos. Ta-Nehisi Coates, welcome back to Fresh Air. You wrote this new book in response to the recent police shootings of African-American people, children and adults. The book is addressed to your teenage son. So when you were growing up in West Baltimore, what did the police mean to you when you were your son's age?
They were another force. So there are two sides of this, you know, because I don't want to be too cynical here. I am an American, and so I did understand them as representing, you know, some aspect of the state that I was a part of, some aspect of the country that I was a part of. But at the same time, there was definitely another part of me that basically recognized them as another element within the society, within the community, with no real moral difference from the crews and the gangs and the, you know, packs of folks who dispensed violence throughout the neighborhood. The police were another force to be negotiated that could dispense violence. And, you know, I want to be, you know, really clear about that, because when you're on the outside, it's very easy to, you know, label a group of, you know, a quote-unquote gang as criminal. But, you know, when you live in the neighborhood, these are people who you see, who you talk to. I mean, everything does not always come to violence. You can negotiate things. You know, there are ways of, you know, dealing with folks. And I talk about that a little bit in the book. And the police were in that respect very much the same way. Just like there's certain rules for how you deal with, you know, a certain crew that lives in a certain place, the police have certain rules for how you negotiate them, too, if you want to avoid violence.
Did you ever see the police as possibly protecting you from violent forces within your own neighborhood?
Yes, I did. But I also saw the crews the same way. You know, that's the interesting thing. I saw many, you know, of my friends who would be labeled as criminals in the same way. The question, you know, for me was, when do you call what? You know what I mean? So if somebody breaks into your house, you would call the police. Again, I don't want to, you know, be overly cynical here. You would call the police. But by the same token, if, you know, you happen to be walking somewhere and five people jumped on you and, you know, did some degree of violence, you probably would not call the police. You might call, you know, some of your cousins, or you might call some of your friends. So it really depended on what the case actually was.
You had a college friend. You went to Howard University, a man named Prince Carmen Jones, who was shot and killed by a policeman. The policeman said it was in self-defense after Jones tried to run him over in his Jeep. And you and everyone who knew Prince Jones didn't believe that story. You write about this in your book. Tell us a little bit about him.
I went to college with Prince Jones. It's very funny because when you write, it becomes sort of abstract for a while, and then when people ask you about it, suddenly it becomes real again. I went to college with Prince Jones. We weren't, you know, best friends or great friends, but he was someone who I knew, who I, you know, spent time around, who I had, you know, just a great deal of affection for. Prince was tall, probably about 6'4" or so, slender, beautiful, beautiful man, very, very handsome. Extremely intelligent. He was from Texas. He went to a magnet school in Texas for math and science, statewide magnet school. As his mom explained to me, he was the only African-American student there. As I, you know, did the interviews for the book and talked to his mother, Mabel Jones, who lives in the Philadelphia area now, when I talked to her, what I realized was he was from a family, a very, very well-to-do family, a mother who had grown up in dirt-poor poverty in Opelousas, Louisiana, whose folks were sharecroppers, who had, you know, basically worked her way out of poverty, had become a radiologist, had gone to LSU, had served in the Navy, you know, had basically done everything America tells you to do, and had, you know, accumulated assets and some degree of wealth. And he was killed. He was killed. I mean, he's executed like an outlaw, as far as I was concerned. The officers were attempting to track down someone who they had believed had stolen a gun from another officer. Somehow they got it in their head that the Jeep that Prince was driving either belonged to the guy who stole the gun or one of his friends. They ran the plates on the Jeep. The Jeep came up with Prince's mother's address and Prince's mother's name in Philadelphia. They assumed that this, you know, could possibly mean that the Jeep was stolen, when in fact all it meant was that his mother had bought it for him. They followed Prince Jones out from the suburbs of Maryland, where they, you know, first began tracking him, into Washington, D.C., and then out into Virginia, where they shot him within, you know, mere feet of his fiancée's home. The thing about this that you know, when I ran it through my mind is this. The basic, you know, report from the officer was that Prince had attempted to back up his Jeep several times and ram the car that the officer was driving. So he had to kill him. He had to shoot him because his life was in danger. But I tried to imagine myself in Prince's shoes. The officer who was tracking him was not in a normal police cruiser. The officer was not in uniform. The officer, in fact, testified that he pulled out his gun, said police, but never showed Prince his badge. The officer was dressed in an undercover disguise like he was supposed to be a drug dealer. And, you know, this is how insidious it gets. I have to imagine myself followed from the suburbs of Maryland through D.C. out into Virginia, realizing at some point that I'm being followed, not having any idea that this is a cop, and then having somebody pull a gun out on me and knowing that I'm near my fiancé's house. So it always seemed to me perfectly logical, you know, that Prince perceived that he was under threat.
Was this ever investigated?
Yes, it was. Nothing came of it. It was investigated by the prosecutor's office out in Fairfax, Virginia, I believe, and nothing ever came of it. There was an internal investigation by the Prince George's County Police Department. The officer was not punished. There was a civil suit eventually where the officer and the police department was found liable. But when I, you know, was checking on this, the officer was not suspended. He had not been punished. He had been previously found to have lied during another case, and the lie was, you know, so bad that the prosecutor's office actually had to throw out every, you know, case in which this officer had testified. The Prince George's County Police Department was at that time under federal consent decree. They were being investigated. The Washington Post did a series of investigative articles on the Prince George's County Police Department around that time, around 2001, 2002, and found that they were more likely than any other police department in the country to fire their guns. The point that his mother made, and I think this is absolutely, absolutely crucial. According to the official record, Prince attempted to kill a police officer, and that's how he died. So according to the official record, it's actually his fault. He's the criminal. He's the one that actually instigated this. That's the last word on his name, which I mean, that is terrible. It's just awful.
This happened nearly 15 years ago. When it happened, what impact did it have on you?
Oh, God.
And I know you were at his funeral or his memorial service at Howard.
How was it? Devastated me. It totally devastated me. A year later, 9/11 happened, and I had no compassion. I had none. I was cold. I was absolutely, absolutely cold because they killed him. They killed him, and no one was held accountable. They sent the officer. They put the officer right back out on the street, right back onto the force. I couldn't believe it. You know, after that, the conclusion I had to draw was that this was a group of people, you know, who had been given, empowered by the state, to use lethal violence. And there was very, very little chance that any of them would be punished. And so should there be a mistake, any sort of mistake with me, any sort of dispute in which I was killed or, you know, my son was killed, in general, I could rest assured that no one would be held accountable. That's very, very different. You know, because people make this comparison between this and quote unquote black on black violence or neighbor on neighbor violence. But see, you know, if somebody in my neighborhood did some degree of violence, I mean, see, there were recourses. There were things that could be done. There was, you know, a mediation, some sort of thing. And sometimes that mediation might, in fact, be violent. But there could be no mediation between me and the state. You know, I mean, they killed Prince and that was it. That was it. End of story. Nothing. Nothing.
So given your personal experience with having a friend who was shot and killed by an undercover police officer who never presented his badge, never showed his identity, put that in context with the more media-covered recent shootings of African-Americans by police. What does that add up to in terms of the message you're trying to give your teenage son now about dealing with police?
I don't know that anything has changed in my mind, like in terms of like how I talk to him. There's a lot of reporting that, you know, depicts this as though there's a wave going on, you know, an uptick in events. But I doubt that there's actually an uptick. More people are paying attention, but I've been paying attention at least, you know, intently for the past 15 years.
Yeah, well, that's why I mentioned the media coverage, because I think that's what's changed, that there's cell phones and the cell phones have led to media coverage. And people are like watching these incidents over and over and over again. And I think for people who haven't been directly exposed to that kind of, you know, police shooting brutality, it's very educational.
It is. And you know, the thing that I, you know, in my mind, and I don't know that we're at this point yet, and, you know, and this is why I say, you know, it really hasn't changed in terms of how I talk to my child, my son. There's a kind of evasion going on wherein people think about what the police did, and they say, well, this is a bad cop, or if we had body cameras, maybe we could do something about it. But there's very little critique about why our police operate the way they operate in the first place. Because that critique ultimately comes back to Americans themselves. We've spent the past, you know, roughly half a century or so growing increasingly draconian, stripping back, you know, people's rights in terms of how they deal with the criminal justice system, increasing the punitive nature of the criminal justice system once people are in the system's clutches. All of that is brought to bear when we think about each of these deaths. Behind each of these is something else, some sort of policy, some sort of decision. I you know, when Prince was killed, I actually did some reporting around his death in PG County, in Prince George's County, because there had been so many other cases like that. You know, and I'll never forget one of the folks telling me that Prince George's County, you know, at that time was one of the most wealthiest enclaves for African Americans in the country. And yet the police was one of the most brutal police departments in the country. How could that possibly be true? Well, you know, many of the citizens out in that county had made the same sort of calculations that white citizens around this country had made. Their great fear was crime, you know, and any sort of hint, any sort of, you know, inkling of crime, from their perspective, the police were empowered to do whatever they wanted. And so ultimately, for me, it's a question of where the citizenry is. You know, it's not just a question of what the police officers are doing. You know, it's a question of what policies, you know, we've decided to pass.
We've been talking about fear of the police and anger at the police. But you know, part of your book is how you lived in fear when you were your son's age, when you were a teenager, when you left the house, because there was a lot of violence in the neighborhood, and you say basically everyone in your neighborhood seemed to be reacting out of fear. You were afraid of other kids. You were afraid of your father's beatings. You write, when I was about our age, each day fully one-third of my brain was concerned with who I was walking to school with, our precise number, the manner of our walk, the number of times I smiled, who or what I smiled at, who offered a pound and who did not. So I guess I'm interested in what were some of the behaviors you had to learn to protect yourself, just like walking to school, walking home from school, going to visit a friend.
Oh, God. Don't walk to school by yourself. Make sure you have at least five or six people with you. It's very interesting when the Philadelphia 76, Allen Iverson, when he came into the league, there was all this critique because he went everywhere with a posse, and there was all this talk about posse. Why is Allen Iverson? And I immediately understood, you know, as a matter of physical safety for many years, you're trained not to go, you know, into places that you don't know about by yourself. Getting back to those rules, don't go to certain neighborhoods unless you know somebody over there, unless, you know, your grandmother's there, unless you got a cousin there, unless you got a really, really close friend there. If you have a girlfriend in another neighborhood, you need to go with four or five or six other people. You guys need to be prepared and, you know, you need to, you know, be watching out. When you walk through the street, as my dad, I can hear my dad telling me this right now, walk like you have some place to be, keep aware, you know, keep your head on a swivel, make sure you're looking, you know, at everything. Little things like understanding that I think about this all the time, that like the first really warm day of the spring or the summer when you're in school is actually a really, really dangerous day for you. Because there's going to be a lot of kids out and people are going to, you know, be feeling a certain way. And it's quite likely that, you know, some amount of violence might occur. And so you need to keep your eyes out on those particular days. Thinking a lot about which way you want to walk. You know, this is just particular to my middle school. I think about this all the time. You know, did you want to walk down the hill? Should you walk up the hill? Should you take a long, circuitous route, as I would sometimes, you know, through other neighborhoods with other friends from those neighborhoods so that you avoid certain people at certain times because they're, you know, already home by then? it's a laundry list. You know, I can remember having, you know, like lunchtime. You know, you might have a problem with somebody. Or somebody might have a problem with you. So you say, well, I'm not going to lunch today. I'm going to, you know, spend my lunch period in the library, which is what I would do sometimes because you don't want to get caught with certain folks. And then it's the more insidious aspect of it, which is this. My disposition is not, you know, to the street at all. You know, it was not anybody who knew me, you know, growing up would tell you there was nothing street about me at all. But, you know, one of the first things I learned within my first year in middle school, because middle school is when you really start getting indoctrinated into this stuff, is that any sort of a physically, you know, violent threat made to you has to be responded to with force. You can't tolerate any, you know, anybody, you know, attempting to threaten or intimidate your body. You must respond with force. This had real repercussions. I mean, you know, like I go to school ninth grade year in my high school, you know, and I, you know, I got suspended for threatening a teacher.
I was going to ask you about that because you refer to that in your new book, and yeah. I don't feel like I understand why that happened. Like, what did you say
I felt
or do
like he
that
disrespected,
was so,
I felt like he disrespected me. It was the same, you know.
By doing what?
He yelled at me in front of the class, like really, really loudly. And again, I mean, this was the sort of thing that you couldn't tolerate.
Is what teachers do sometimes.
I know. But see, it sounds like you're laughing because, like, it's funny if you've never been in the environment
where all you have is your dignity.
That's all you have. I mean, you know, teachers yell loudly at kids from time to time. You're exactly right. But if you live in an environment, you know, if you're, you know, from a place where all you have is, like, the basic, you know, sort of physical respect, you will talk to me in a respectful way. You don't have anything else to lean on. That's very serious. That's really, really, really serious, you know. If somebody yelled at me now, it probably would, you know, I'd, you know, sort of walk away and laugh. Well, I've accumulated certain things. I have certain things. I have a family. You know, I feel, you know, great personal value in myself and in my work and in what I do. I feel, you know, deeply loved by everyone around me. I don't feel like I live in a particularly violent environment. I wouldn't perceive being yelled at, you know, as necessarily communicating to other people around me that they, too, could disrespect me at any moment.
So you threaten the teacher and then you're arrested. Like what? Mm-hmm. How did that? What did you say?
I said something to the fact that, you know, if you say something like that to me again, I'm gonna knock you out. It was something, but it was a physical threat.
Wow. Okay.
And in that moment, I was not like it was not idle either. I was very angry. Uh-huh. I was really angry.
So who called the police? The teacher or the principal?
He did. We had school police.
School police. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. He called the police. The teacher called the police. Police came. And I probably, as I recall it, I got into some sort of verbal thing with the police, too. The police handcuffed me. and took me downstairs. They called my parents. They wrote up an arrest report and everything. Eventually, they unhandcuffed me and released me and sent me home by myself to my parents. I hate saying this. Or maybe this is just what happened, okay? And I wrote the book, and I've written a book about this before. It's out there. It's the public record. They released me. I went home. My dad kicked my butt. And that was the moment, you know, where, like, and I've said this several times, where he says to my mom, and I see this clearly, you know, my mom was really, you know, upset and had never really been upset about, you know, my dad dealing out physical discipline. My mom would deal out physical discipline. My mom beat kids. I mean, but it really upset my mom, the sight of it. You know, I was 14. I, you know, was, you know, becoming a big kid by then. And she tried to stop him. And he said to her, you know, either I can do it or the police. And so I go through this thing in the book about fear and what I understand now. And this don't make it okay. And this doesn't mean that it's what I would do. But what I understand now is how deeply afraid my parents were when they heard I got arrested. I remember my mom later, you know, after all this, you know, blew up, maybe like a couple hours later that same day, talking to me about it and just like crying, like just breaking down and crying. And there are African-American families, you know, around this country, a large number of African that just operate out of complete fear that their kids are going to be taken from them and will do anything, you know, to prevent that.
My guest is Ta-Nehisi Coates, a national correspondent for The Atlantic and author of the new book, Between the World and Me. After a break, we'll talk about tough choices he's had to make raising his son. And Maureen Corrigan will review Harper Lee's newly published novel, which reads like a sequel to her novel To Kill a Mockingbird, but is going to baffle and upset a lot of readers because this time Atticus Finch is depicted as a racist. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This episode of Fresh Air and the following message are made possible by The Great Courses, engaging audio and video courses presented by top professors for the pure pleasure of learning. The Great Courses has over 500 courses, including The Art of Storytelling, which provides insight into the history of narrative and tools to enhance storytelling skills. For a limited time, The Great Courses is offering up to 80% off a selection of their best-selling courses, including The Art of Storytelling. Get this special offer at thegreatcourses.com/freshair.
You've commented over the years about how a lot of people, even people who know you, don't know how to spell your name. They get it wrong. People who don't know you don't know how to pronounce your name. I should say your name is spelled, your first name, Ta-Nehisi, is spelled T-A-hyphen, that is, N-E-H-I-S-I. And you're named after.
Oh, am I filling in here?
Yeah, you're filling in.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I'm named after. It's an ancient Egyptian name for ancient Nubia, actually. And it's so funny because people become so interested in it. You know, been people doing etymology for me, and apparently the Ta portion of it means land, and then. The Nehisi portion of it, apparently there are no actual, you know, vowels in ancient Egyptian, so people put vowels in order to make it pronounceable, but it is a designation for people who are browner, blacker, or darker skinned. As the name was given to me, it was literally land of the blacks or land of the black people.
Your son is named Samori.
Yes.
And tell us who you named him after and how your name guided you or didn't guide you in deciding how to name your son.
Well, the first thing is my name is difficult to pronounce. So I wanted to give him a name with some meaning, and I had, you know, some sense of, you know, the black diaspora. I wanted people to be able to pronounce his name. That was really, really important to me. I wanted, you know, people to be able to read it and basically be able to say it. Samori is named for Samori Toure, who was, you know, during the period of colonialism, was one of the last and rather more effective folks to try to resist French colonialism in West Africa. And I gave him that name, you know, thinking about struggle and thinking about resistance and thinking that, you know, because Samori Toure ultimately failed. You know, his country, his nation was ultimately colonized. But I gave him that name thinking about the idea that resistance means something even when you're not successful, that struggle means something even when you're not successful, that struggle and resistance in and of themselves are values. And I've tried to communicate that to him all his life.
Your piece on reparations which was a cover story for The Atlantic a year ago and won a bunch of awards. It, among other things, it documented government housing regulations and private housing covenants that prevented African-American people from moving into certain buildings or into certain neighborhoods. It forced many African-Americans to buy overpriced homes in ghettoized neighborhoods. Is what you describe the history of white-imposed disadvantage. Do you see that in your neighborhood, in the neighborhood you grew up in Baltimore, and do you think your parents' presence in that neighborhood, do you think the fact that you were raised in that neighborhood had anything to do with the kind of government-imposed and restrictions and private governments that you later wrote about?
Yes, it's not even theory. I mean, it's just that is a great book. I believe it's called Not in My Neighborhood, about redlining in Baltimore. Yes. I mean, any person listening to this program right now can go and Google redlining map for any major city. Baltimore was one of those cities. We got to be very clear about what housing segregation meant and what, and just forgive me, I'm going to try to unspool this for a second. We had a period in the late 1930s into the 1940s, into the early 1950s, where there was a huge investment made into housing and home ownership in this country. And the basic idea was that we needed to, create, a broader middle class. And so folks were given money, government-backed loans, effectively, to move into, certain neighborhoods to better their lives. Folks were given money through the GI Bill, to get better education, a social safety net was erected in this country. In almost every case, when you go through every one of these laws, when you go through FHA loans, when you go through Social Security, when you go through unemployment, when you go even through welfare, when you go through the GI Bill, at every level, you can find discrimination against Black people. So at the very moment in the 40s and 50s, we're erecting a modern class. And housing is the biggest one because housing is how most folks accumulate wealth in this country. You can see just systemic discrimination against African Americans. If you were a Black family in Baltimore, Maryland, in the 1950s, when my grandmother was raising children in the projects, in the Gilmore Homes projects in Baltimore, Maryland, and you wanted to buy into a certain neighborhood, well, you didn't have freedom. You didn't have. I mean, you were lucky if you, first of all, you accumulated the money in the first place to buy in a certain neighborhood. And when you did, you certainly did not have the right to live wherever you wanted. You didn't have the same choice that other Americans had. If you wanted, you say, well, I don't like this neighborhood. There's too much crime. The schools aren't good enough. Let me move over. Well, you didn't have that right.
I want to get back to the shootings at the Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. A lot of people from that church placed an emphasis on the power of forgiveness. And you write, I've always felt great, and this is in relation to another shooting. You write, I've always felt great distance from the grieving rituals of my people. And I'm wondering what you meant by that and how it applies, if at all, to what you felt watching people grieve in Charleston.
I mean, it applies to this, and I don't understand the forgiveness aspect of this. I just don't. I understand the politics of it. Like, I understand that created room for people to take down the Confederate flag. I have that. I understand not living with hatred. I understand how that can be corrupting. I got that. I don't understand how you gunned down my wife, my mother, my father, my child. And when I see you 3 days later, I say that I forgive you. I don't understand that. That doesn't make it right or wrong, but it's just not something that, and forgiveness is a big part of, especially post-civil rights movement, is a big part of African-American Christianity. And I wasn't raised within the Christian church. I wasn't raised within any church. Forgiveness is a huge, huge part of it coming out of the civil rights movement. I can't access that at all. It doesn't mean that, I necessarily, well, I probably would have some degree of hate, if it were my relative. But I don't quite get it, It doesn't, I can't imagine feeling that way. I guess that's what I would say. I can't imagine feeling that way.
My impression of you is that you've tried to channel the kind of anger that you do feel, having studied systemic racism in the U.S. You've tried to channel that into explanation, into investigation and explanation. How did this happen? What are the lasting, continuing consequences? and
right,
how
that gets
do
me
we
as
talk
close
about
to
it?
Peace. Yeah. Yes, yes, yes. I mean, and it's mostly, you know, quite frankly, Terry, is selfish. I mean, it's mostly explanation for myself. If I can make it comprehensible, if I can understand it, maybe I can't make peace with it. It doesn't make it okay. But I get it. I get it. It's not mysterious. It's not mysterious. And I think, like, that's one of the, you know, the worst aspects of racism. It's, you know, you feel a certain way about living in America and about your country, about how you're treated. And yet so much of everything around you portrays it as though it's mysterious, but it's not. It's not after you do, you know, some amount of reading, you know, about the country, you know, and about its society. It's not mysterious. It gives me a weird sense of relief, by the way.
Relief?
Yeah. Yeah. Because I'm not crazy.
Right. Okay.
I'm not crazy. When I was in Baltimore, you know, and I reacted that certain way, you know, even the ways that I'm deeply ashamed of, I was not crazy. I was not crazy. You know, I was in a situation and I was trying to do the best I can. I did not always make the wisest choices, but I was not crazy. I was not any lazier than anybody else. I was not any less hardworking. I was not any more lacking in morals. I had a father. You know, I had a mother. I was loved. I had people around me. I was just in a situation, you know, and had any, you know, other human been in a similar situation, it's quite likely that they might have reacted the same way.
You've described how when you were young, your father beat you, and sometimes he beat you for getting into trouble, like when you threatened your teacher after your teacher hollered at you in what you saw as a very humiliating way in front of the class. But your father also beat you once for not standing up to the person who stole something from you. And you felt like, well, okay, he's beating me for being violent. He's beating, you know, for speaking violently. He's beating me for not being violent enough. But you understood that he was also beating you because he said to you, "If it's either me or the police." And he was beating you in a way that he hoped would kind of discipline you and protect you from getting into bigger trouble. So that's how you were raised. What about raising your son? Would you hit him? Would you take off your belt and hit him with that, like you were raised?
So, in fairness to my dad, I should say my mom and my dad. It was not the case that my mom did not, you know, hit me either. I just don't, because fathers sometimes take the blame, you know, take all of this, you know, mm-hmm. to extend this blame to be doled out. Yeah, I have hit my son before. I can count, I believe, on, I'm thinking of it now, I think three times. In his life, I would never hit him with an object. I've never hit him with a belt. I had a pretty big rule in my house about disrespect, and I say had because he's so old now that we're pretty much past all of this. But I had a pretty big rule in my house about disrespect, and by which I mean, and maybe this, you know, I'm having this conversation with you, maybe this, you know, hails back to something really old, but I wanted him to talk to his mother in a certain way. And I wanted him to talk to me in a certain way, and I wanted him to talk to adults in a certain way. And I wanted to communicate that to him. Like, it was like the big, big thing in my house. And so every time, you know, that I hit him, it was usually because of that. He usually had said something really, really crosswise to his mom or to me that was, like, beyond, you know, what I felt, the realm of things that should be said. Now, I recently had a conversation with him. I was 24 when Samari was born. His mom was 23. And, you know, again, your kids are born and you have all of this great sort of fear. I hit him, you know, three times, maybe four times in his life. But I told him recently that if I had it to do again and if I had a kid right now, I would resolve not to hit the kid at all. I didn't have that sort of resolution when I knew that I didn't want to do it much. And I knew that I, you know, it was like a real, real last resort for me. I had that when he was born. But if I was doing it now, I just wouldn't hit the kid at all. You know, I just.
What's changed? Why wouldn't you know?
Because he's going to be okay. And I didn't know that when I was a kid. You know, I thought he might go out and disrespect somebody and he'd get shot. Like, that was what was in my head. You know what I mean? Like, he mouthed off at a police officer and, you know, he'd get the hell be out. Like, that was what was in my head. You know, it wasn't just, I'm personally offended by how you're talking. No, you disrespect somebody, brother, it's dangerous out here for you. It is dangerous out here for you. And I have to communicate that to you. And I'm more confident. And maybe it's because as he grew older, you know, especially now, you know, and I guess especially over the past probably about 4 or 5 years, you know, he's 14, he'll be 15 in August. And so your relationship with kids evolves. It changes. And, you know, you can see, you know, what the kid, you know, is becoming and how you deal with the kid changes. And I guess there are a couple things going on, okay? The first thing is I've seen how my son has grown, you know, and I've seen how maybe things that when he was younger, I would have thought of as, oh, my God, I got to get this out of you, because if you continue like this, you know, until you're 20, this, you know, this could be a threat to your life. I can now see them as him being a child. Like, you say, oh, you're a child, and this is what children do. Okay. All right. Got that. The second thing is to be quite honest with you, have raised my son largely around a different class of people. And I mean literal social class. You know, right. Who don't hit their kids, by and large. And I have seen their kids do, to be honest with you, all sorts of things that would have, you know, just my head would have exploded if somebody had done some of these things. And they don't hit their kids. And my initial reaction is, you're out of your mind. That was my initial. You're crazy. That's why your kids are, you know, out here doing X, Y, and Z. But I've seen those kids now, like I'm old enough, and I've seen those kids go off to college. I've seen those kids straighten out. You know, I've seen those kids, you know, basically, you know, grow into adults and mature. And I've seen it basically the parents were right. The parents understood that they were children doing, you know, some of the things that children did. And I think, you know, from an African-American perspective, you know, what folks hearing this would say was like, yes, but, you know, those a lot of those children are white, and they are. A lot of those children are white and have more room to do X, Y, and Z. Well, that's true. But when you accept that, you kind of bring the injustice to the child. You put the injustice of the world. You know what I mean? You say, well, we don't have much room to do X, Y, and Z, and so I'm going to do this to you.
My impression hearing you talk right now is that because you're African-American and because you grew up in West Baltimore in a neighborhood that was often violent, that the calculations that you have to do in terms of getting along in the world, raising your son, are more complicated. Maybe I'm just stating
they
the
are.
Obvious.
No, but I think you summarized everything I was trying to say.
That they're just more complicated than your white counterpart.
They are, and they definitely are. They definitely are. They definitely are. I didn't really know people. Well, I did know. I knew one father that was this way. But in general, I didn't really know people, with that exception, that came home, like, had a bad day and then beat the hell out of their kids. That was not, like, the environment I was really raised around. Like I said, I can think of one exception to that. But by and large, I mean, this was the way folks dealt with their kids, the way folks disciplined their kids was the way all of their peers disciplined their kids, the way they had been disciplined as kids, the way their parents had been disciplined as kids. People have this conversation now about a spanking and about beating and about, you know, hitting children. But I understand it. Like I said, I wouldn't put my hands on my kid now. Now I wouldn't do it. But I just think it's really important to understand where that comes from.
What did you have to learn about loving your son as a father that was different from how you were loved?
I had to learn not to be so hard. I had to learn to not be so hard. And I had a wife, and at that time a partner when Samari was born, and for most of Samari's life a partner, who for whatever reason did not have to learn that and was very tender and very, very soft with him. And I didn't, when I saw that, for whatever reason, I didn't process that as, oh, that's his mother, she's being that way. Like, I immediately wondered why I wasn't that way. You know, and I labored, I very, very much labored to be that way, you know, to be softer, to be, you know, affectionate, you know, to tell him, you know, little things, to tell him I love you every night and to kiss him every night before he went to bed. You know, my parents love me. It's just not something that we did. It wasn't manifested in that way. I learned it from my spouse. I learned it from my wife. And now, as you know, we enter into this period, you know, he's going on to 15, and I can see the end, and I'm sad. Like, you know, I'm learning that this is not going to be forever, that he's going to leave me one day. I'm very happy I did that, you know, because if anything ever happens to me, or God forbid anything ever happens to him, it cannot be said that I did not make it clear to him every day how much I loved him.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Ta-Nehisi Coates is a national correspondent for The Atlantic and author of the new book, Between the World and Me. The literary event of the summer is almost upon us. Harper Lee's novel, Ghost Set a Watchman, goes on sale tomorrow. Book critic Maureen Carrigan has this review.
As another Southern writer once said, you can't go home again. In Harper Lee's Ghost Set a Watchman, which takes place in the mid-1950s, a 26-year-old Scout Finch takes the train from New York City home to Macomb, Alabama, and finds the familiar world turned mighty strange. TV and air conditioning have changed the landscape, and beloved childhood friends like Dill and her brother Jem have vanished. Others, like Calpurnia, look at Scout, here called by her grown-up name of Jean Louise, as though she were, well, a white lady. And then there's Atticus. Now 72 and crippled by arthritis, he's still a wry patriarch. But in one of the novel's key scenes, set as in To Kill a Mockingbird in Macomb's courthouse, Atticus allies himself with a kind of men who several years later stood shoulder to shoulder with Bull Connor and George Wallace. Ghost Set a Watchman is a troubling confusion of a novel, politically and artistically, beginning with its fishy origin story. Allegedly, it's a recently discovered first draft of To Kill a Mockingbird, but I'm suspicious. It reads much more like a failed sequel. There are lots of dead patches in Ghost Set a Watchman, pages where we get long explanations of, say, the fine points of the Methodist worship service. The novel turns on the adult Scout's disillusionment with her father, a disillusionment that lovers of To Kill a Mockingbird will surely share. Reeling from the Supreme Court's recent ruling in Brown versus the Board of Education, Atticus reveals himself as a segregationist and a reactionary extremist. He's a staunch proponent of states' rights, a critic of federal programs, even popular ones like Social Security and the GI Bill, and a foe of the NAACP. One could say, as some commentators already have, that Atticus here displays layers of contradictory attitudes about race harbored by whites, no matter how progressive. But no, this Atticus is different in kind, not just degree. He's like Ahab turned into a whale lover, or Holden Caulfield, a phony. In To Kill a Mockingbird, Atticus was his own man. Here, he essentially tells Scout, you have to go along to get along. This Atticus, we're told, joined the Ku Klux Klan in his youth. Now, he's on the local citizens' council. This Atticus is a eugenicist. He believes in racial theory and reads pamphlets with titles like The Black Plague. He warns the horrified Scout that we're outnumbered here in Macomb and observes that our Negro population is backward, and Negroes down here are still in their childhood as a people. Scout, who takes up her fallen father's torch of progressivism, likens his views to those of Hitler and Goebbels. Yet the more poignant revelations in Ghost Set a Watchman have to do with Scout. At 26, she's still a sort of tomboy, talking herself into marrying a childhood friend named Hank. At least half of this novel is devoted to Scout or Jean Louise's torment over not feeling like she has a place in the world. In a moving set piece about halfway through the novel, Scout dutifully attends a coffee that her prim Aunt Alexandra hosts for her. She wanders from group to group of women, the newlyweds, the diaper set, and feels alienated. We're told that Scout glanced down the long living room at the double row of women, women she had merely known all her life, and she could not talk to them 5 minutes without drying up stone dead. I ached for this adult Scout. The civil rights movement may be gathering force, but the second women's movement hasn't happened yet. I want it to transport Scout to our own time, take her to a performance of Fun Home on Broadway, to know that if she could only hang on, the possibilities for non-conforming tomboys will open up. Lee herself, writing in the 1950s, lacks the language and social imagination to fully develop this potentially powerful theme. The novel goes on sale tomorrow, and everybody who loves To Kill a Mockingbird is going to read it, no matter what I or any other reviewer says about its literary quality, the bizarre transformation of Atticus, or its odd provenance. All I know for certain is that Go Set a Watchman is kind of a mess that will forever change the way we read a masterpiece.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University and is the author of So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. She reviewed Go Set a Watchman by Harper Lee. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, medical marijuana. Is it effective? If so, for what symptoms? And is it safe? We talk with Dr. David Kasseret about his new book, Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. He directs the Hospice and Palliative Care Program at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Ganny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Hi, podcast listeners. Stick around for a few more minutes. Here's our podcast extra, something we didn't have time for in our radio broadcast. Ta-Nehisi Coates talks about some of the behaviors he had to learn in order to protect himself from the violence in the West Baltimore neighborhood he grew up in.
You have to walk around looking like the kind of person who will respond with force. That's your basic demeanor. That's the mask that you wear throughout the day. And it could be the smallest thing. Somebody bump into you in the hall. Well, you can't just let that slide. You know, somebody step on your shoes. You can't just let that slide because maybe other people then see that and they decide that they're going to do other things to you. You know what I mean? Maybe somebody says something to you, you know, a joke, you know, an offensive joke, and you don't like it. Well, you know, you immediately, you know, jump to threats, you know, if you're not capable of, you know, responding with equal humor, because you can't let any of these other people think that they can put something over on you, that they can intimidate you. That was the lesson of my first year in middle school. And the very, very sad thing is these lessons stick with you even after you move into worlds in which, and I'm speaking, you know, for myself here, when you move into worlds where they are no longer appropriate or necessary. That can be really dangerous.
What did that mean in your life? Like, let me give you an example. You write that the first time you really came into contact in a deep and meaningful way was when you started writing for weeklies in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. and you became mm-hmm. a journalist, and you had white editors, or you had white colleagues there. So did you ever feel like you were inappropriately or unnecessarily, like, combative or defensive or, you know, inappropriate in your gestures or your face?
Yes, but not towards them. The example that I think of in my mind, I worked for, you know, the great journalist David Carr at Washington City Paper. And this was in the mid-90s, just as D.C. is beginning to gentrify. And I was going into the office one day with one of my editors, and we were getting onto the elevator. And there was an older African-American man, a little bit older than me, on the elevator with me. And we got into some sort of verbal dispute. I think I asked him to hold the elevator or something. And, you know, we start going back and forth. And he said something about one of my white colleagues who was with me. And the way it came across was that, you know, he was basically trying to, you know, say that I was somehow not even less black, but like a punk, because I was, you know, hanging out with these white people, something like that, right? And it's just, I mean, just really, really, like, I went from 0 to 100, like, in 1 second, you know. And then he reached into his jacket in a gesture that was very, very familiar to me, you know, from when I was a child, when people would reach into their jacket as though they had a gun, and I knew he didn't have a gun, and I pushed him. You know, and after, you know, it blew over and he walked away, I had to go upstairs and tell David Carr about this, which was, you know, David was a very, very intimidating, you know, individual. And I knew, like, within a minute after it had happened, maybe 30 seconds after I had calmed down, that this was totally inappropriate. Like, it was completely, completely, completely inappropriate. But, you know, I was operating on rules. You know, that, so I would have been 20, 21 at that time, that were useful to me no less than 3 or 4 years ago. In fact, I was, you know, living where I did in Washington, D.C. I was actually operating on rules that were useful to me at that time, but were just not appropriate in the workplace.
What was David Carr's reaction when you told him this?
He went after me at first, and so, you know, and then he told me he completely understood. So he's very nasty with me at first, you know, and yelled, rah, 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 you know, and then probably about a day later, he said, yeah, I got it. I understand.
You say in your book that there were always like assemblies honoring the civil rights movement, I guess Martin Luther King Day, and those really kind of puzzled you or made you angry. And you would think things like, what did the emphasis on nonviolence mean in this neighborhood? And how could our teacher send us out into the streets of Baltimore knowing that, knowing the violence that was out there, and then speak of nonviolence? Did you feel like the lessons of the civil rights movement just like weren't going to be useful to you on the street? Like,
I couldn't understand.
Civil disobedience isn't going to work walking to school?
I mean, it wasn't even just in the street. Like, by that point, I'm thinking about middle school, so I had some awareness of the country, so it wasn't even just the school. I mean, you knew the schools were somehow connected to the country, right? Like, you knew that. You know, the schools are a public institution. They're a part of the country. And the country wasn't nonviolent. Like, it's quite clear. The country was, like, not just my neighborhood was violent. But when I looked out, I understood that, you know, whatever power the country had was established and enforced and protected through violence. So on a deeply personal level of walking down the street, you're correct. You know, you have to deal with folks where, you know, nonviolence is just not going to be a thing. You know, most of those teachers I assumed had kids and were like my parents. They beat their kids. So they, you know, they were violent with their kids. Everybody I knew was like that. What were we talking about? What applicability did that have? What was that? You know, I could not understand how I could live in a world where fear and violence was all around me. And where some of the same people who talked about nonviolence and preached nonviolence were directly responsible or indirectly responsible for that violence could do that. It just made no sense to me at all. And I have to say, to a large degree, does not make sense to me today.
I want to talk with you a little about the Confederate flag, which is being taken down in South Carolina. The shootings, the killings, the murders at the Emanuel AME Church in South Carolina, and the racist things that the shooter said, have led to a national discussion about the meaning of the Confederate flag. Businesses, a lot of businesses are stopping selling those flags and stopping selling anything with those flags printed on them. And the book that you wrote now was originally supposed to be a collection of essays about the Civil War. I imagine you'll be writing that at a later time.
But maybe, we hope.
maybe, okay. But you've spent a lot of time studying the Civil War. You spent a lot of time going to Civil War battlefields and monuments. And based on everything that you've learned about the Civil War, what does the Confederate flag mean to you? What do you see when you see it?
When I see the Confederate flag, I see the attempt to raise an empire in slavery. It's just that, you know, it really, really is that simple. I don't understand how anybody with any sort of education on the Civil War can see anything else. Any investigation of the primary documents from the Confederacy as to, you know, why, you know, they were seceding and why, you know, they were creating, they were attempting to create their own country, mentioned slavery repeatedly as the reason for it. And not just to create a separate empire of slavery in the southern United States that would be peaceful and not bother anyone else, but an expansive empire of slavery that had, you know, designs on Cuba, that has designs on the tropics, that wanted to actually expand the land for slavery. That, I don't know. I mean, the Mississippi Declaration of Secession says, you know, very clearly, you know, our interests are you know, thoroughly aligned with the institution of African slavery. When Alexander Stevens, the vice president of the Confederacy, gives his, you know, cornerstone speech where he's talking about the cornerstone of the Confederacy, he literally calls out Thomas Jefferson and rejects the idea of all men are created equal and says our new country, our new republic, our new nation, whatever he calls it, is founded on directly the opposite position, that the Negro is not the equal of the white, that slavery is his natural position. And, you know, these folks don't just talk about this idea like shamefully or regrettably. No, they think it is, you know, one of the greatest and most attractive, you know, moral ideas in the country's history. If you go back and read John C. Calhoun, who's considered, you know, a great statesman from South Carolina, and his statements about, he calls slavery a positive good. I mean, that's a positive good, not shameful, not something that we're coping with, not a problem with, a positive good. And it goes further than that. I mean, if you read, you know, into the quote unquote intellectuals, you know, of the proto-Confederacy of slavery, they talk about slavery as an organizing sociological principle. The idea that because you have an underclass of black people, one third of the South enslaved, the majority of people in South Carolina, the majority of people in Louisiana, the majority of people in Mississippi living in chains, that actually tamps down disputes between working class whites and aristocratic whites. This is not like socialist back reading. They actually say it. They say it. They say, you know, with us, you know, the difference between in our society, the difference is between the white and the black, not between the rich and the poor. And so it's very difficult for me to see anything, you know, but an empire of slavery when I see the Confederate flag.
So do you think that are you encouraged by the fact that so many Confederate flags are coming down now?
Yes, I am. I am. And more than that, I'm not just encouraged by the fact that, you know, so many Confederate flags are coming down. I'm encouraged by the logic behind it. So when you see Paul Thurmond, Strom Thurmond's son, stand up and say, listen, what these people were fighting for was for slavery. When he doesn't, you know, do the state's rights dance and try to, you know, attempt. No, it was slavery. When you see Rand Paul, you know, stand up and say, you know, listen, it's a racist symbol. Yes, that's encouraging.